Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, October 6th, welcome to the show, friends. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I am living the life of a showboy. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Well, Avi, you probably noticed there's a lot happening right now. There's possible peace talks abroad over the war in Gaza. There's a government shutdown. Today is day six. There's political fights from Washington to Harrisburg. There's even a controversy over the Super Bowl halftime show.
Wouldn't be the Super Bowl halftime show without a controversy.
Yeah, so today we're doing a political roundtable. We have two really smart people lined up. They're going to come in. They have very different viewpoints, but we're going to do things a little bit differently than we've done in the past. We've built more of a structured roundtable. We hope that it is quick, that it's focused, that it moves fast so we can get to as many of the big stories, both nationally, internationally, and locally as we can. We're only going to spend like a few minutes on each topic, but, you know, we also want to hear from you, our listeners. What is the story that is top of your mind? And of course, tell us why. And if there's an angle to a story that we may be missing, let us know what that is. You can participate in the conversation by calling 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, share the video. I mean, share the show with your friends, okay? And then leave your comments in the chat.
Slight edit, the back half of the show will be dedicated exclusively to Taylor Swift album reactions. So get those in.
I'm like, what? No, local, yes. People might say that's a story that we've missed. So.
Yeah, we are not planning to talk about the Taylor Swift album, but if you have thoughts about it, let me know specifically. I'll give you my personal email. We'll talk about it. But yeah, 888-477-9499. What news story are you following and why? Is there an angle we're missing? Studio2@whyy.org. But first, a trio of local news stories, some headlines here, Cherry. Starting with some positive news to report here in Philadelphia.
I'm positive, yeah.
Fatalities involving drug overdoses dropped in 2024, a 20% decline from 2023, which itself was a drop from the peak of 2022. And according to Mayor Rindy at Billy Penn, preliminary data from the first part of 2025 suggests another drop in overdose deaths could be around the corner. It's possible that this year will be the first with fewer than 1,000 overdose deaths in Philadelphia since 2016. Wow. Why? Well, I would encourage you to read the story by Mayor Rindy at Billy Penn. He did a great deep dive into all of the potential reasons, but we did want to note this news. It seems like there's a sustained decrease in overdose deaths here in Philly.
Yeah, lots of reasons, to think about. And I think about all the work that was done to get Narcan in the hands of so many people. I even have Narcan at home because someone knocked on my door and they were giving it out. And Prevention Point said they gave out 114,000 doses of Narcan, which was an uptick of 13% from their previous year. So there's been a lot of work. There's more beds for people to get into recovery. I mean, as you mentioned, Mayor Rendy did a great job, but there's been a lot of resources, a lot of attention on this, and it looks like it may be working at least locally.
And you can't discount the fact that during the pandemic, life was disrupted.
It
people
was.
Were cut
it
off
was.
From their support networks. Mm-hmm. That has obviously receded somewhat over the last couple of years. And so that might be part of the equation as well. Also, the makeup of the drug supply itself. Mayor dove into that and why new types of street drugs, while very, very harmful, might be less likely to lead to overdose. There's so many possible reasons. And of course, isolating which of these is driving the decrease is so important as we move forward.
Yeah. And the good news is fewer people are dying. The bad news is people are still dying and there's more work to be done. Second story, as e-bikes have become more powerful, regulation of what folks are calling in some cases motorcycles with pedals, well, it's falling behind. The Philadelphia Inquirer today did a deep dive on the rise of e-bikes, reporting that, you know, e-bikes, you know, e-motos and other forms of micro mobility, as it has become more popular, the country has seen a spike in injuries, and some of them are pretty severe. Some trauma centers have reported seeing a 60% increase in e-bike injuries just, you know, as the data in many cases just doesn't exist. That's how fast the popularity of these devices have grown. And I should mention that Pennsylvania law limits e-bikes to about 750 watts with a max of about 20 miles per hour. But people are using e-bikes that are 3,000 watts. It can go up to 50 miles per hour. And these are the machines that are motorcycles with pedals, right? And
sometimes the pedals don't even work.
They don't even work.
They're just fake pedals.
And so it's really hard for law enforcement to determine whether this is a legal e-bike or if it's illegal. And a lot of these folks are sort of flying under the radar. That means law enforcement, you know, is lagging. It also means that, you know, lawmakers are lagging behind. And so in New Jersey and elsewhere, people are trying to decide, do you just ban them? Right? Do you ban them for kids? Do you have more regulation? And if so, how do you do it? So there's a debate just that is brewing. But the bottom line is law enforcement is lagging behind and so is regulation.
Good story by the Inquirer. Yeah. I encourage folks to read that one as well. I think banning feels reactionary to me.
Yeah.
It's throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Clearly there's a problem here.
But
these micromobility options really change the game for lots of people getting around the city, folks with kids, folks mm-hmm. with mobility issues, and they're environmentally friendly.
Yes.
And so there's a lot of upside to e-bikes, but clear downside as well. And one of the things that this story really highlighted is the fact that these e-motorcycles, let's call them what they are, they're really not e-bikes. These high-powered e-motorcycles are A, pretty cheap and pretty easy to doctor. And so, you know, obviously motorcycles are very dangerous, but it's hard to get your hands on a motorcycle. Mm-hmm. It's hard to take a normal bike.
And you need and a license. You need insurance. Right. You need all those things.
The barriers to entry for getting an e-bike or an e-motorcycle essentially are so much lower, which means the proliferation has been so much faster. So how do you stop that? Mm-hmm. Is it enforcement? Is it education? It's probably a little bit of both. But of course, it worries me that people might be going the ban route because there's so much upside to these ways of getting around and they accomplish things that we want to accomplish as a society. So just putting that out there.
Yeah, I wanted to throw out one little data point that just came out. In 2024, Pennsylvania State Police reported that there were 345 vehicle crashes involving e-bikes, representing about 27% of all bicycle-related crashes. And that's just 1 year of data that they've collected. So it's a pretty big deal and it's significant.
And it's only the crashes that are logged by the state police.
And so, they're not logging all of them.
But what's important, they're definitely not logging all of them because the state police would not be involved in many e-bike crashes. But what's so important to note there is the 27% number.
Yeah,
that's huge proportion considering that most people who are using a bike are not using an e-bike. Mm-hmm. So it just shows you how, you know, potentially dangerous they are. But again, good story from the Inky.
Yep.
Finally, a story from our WHYY pal, Nicole Leonard, about some historic images being donated to the University of Pennsylvania. The donation consists of two thin glass plates discovered kind of by accident by the family of former Penn doctor Arthur Godspeed. These are very fuzzy images taken in 1896, and they are considered some of the oldest X-ray images in the world. And speaking of accidents, Godspeed made his first X-rays by mistake. In 1890, he and a colleague left some coins on top of a stack of photographic plates. Then they started futzing around unrelatedly with some glass tubes that emit radiation. Now, at the same time, across the world in Europe, a German scientist was discovering how to actually create X-ray images. And when his, you know, research came out, Godspeed thought back to the images he had made in 1890 and said, whoa, wait a second, I think I accidentally made some X-rays. And so those are some of the earliest ever recorded. Pretty cool and gives you an insight into how science works. Sometimes mistakes can be a beautiful thing.
I know. To realize you were actually the first. It must have been a little bit mind-blowing there. But everything, I always say everything comes back to Philly.
Always.
It always comes back to Philly. And clear, I mean, it was pretty clear he didn't have any idea of what he actually created and how it really worked or how impactful you know, his invention would be. I just went to the dentist not too long ago, an X-ray of my tooth. So there you
everywhere.
Go.
It's everywhere. It's still so useful. It's such an important technology. And it actually reminded me, there's this thing called the Philadelphia chromosome, which was also discovered here and by accident. And it was a big turning point in discovering the genetic link to cancer. And again, these guys just sort of stumbled upon it. And science, in some ways, is more art than science.
Like, it is.
Obviously, there's lots of really intentional experimentation going on, but you also have to give people the freedom to just stumble around.
Futz around, as you said.
What happens. You know, there's so many little tangents you can go down in the world of science, and sometimes those tangents turn into something much more than tangents.
And it's really an important reminder of that. And made things so good, so wonderful.
Speaking of Godspeed, Godspeed to us as we embark on our first political roundtable. What news story are you following and why? Is there an angle we're missing? Coming back on the other side of this break, we're going to talk about some of the biggest stories happening nationally and internationally with our panel. We want to hear from you. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. There is so much happening in the news right now. So today we decided to do a little political roundtable. We're dividing the show into two parts. First, we'll go big, spend some time on national and international headlines dominating the news right now. And then for the second part of the show, we're going to zoom in and focus on some of the biggest news in our region.
And we're going to do it a little differently from our roundtables of the past. We put in some structure and we want to speed things up. We'll spend just a few minutes on each topic so we can cover more ground. And we have the perfect guest with us in studio today to help us slog through it all. We have Terry Tracy, founder of Broad and Liberty and CEO of Fidari News Network. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me back.
And of course, we also have Solomon Jones, columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer and host on WURD Radio. Solomon, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
And we want to invite you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere to participate in the conversation. What news story are you following and why? Is there an angle we're missing? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
So we're going to start with National Guard. The Trump administration has made several attempts to deploy National Guard troops to Portland, Oregon, despite a federal judge's repeated orders to desist. This administration will not stand down. And in your view, how does this deployment to Portland sort of differ or is similar to the ramp up that we've seen in D.C. and Chicago and other places? Solomon, we'll start with you and then we'll have Terry jump in.
Well, I think in Portland, the one big difference is that the mayor is not black. That's number one. Mm-hmm. Let's just start there and let's just put it out there. But it is a Democratic city. It is a very progressive city. It's a liberal leaning city. And they have been protesting pretty vociferously for a while now. I think the difference with what we see with how the judge is responding is that this is a Trump appointed judge. Mm-hmm. And this judge is leaning on the law, not on political bias, not on what Trump wants her to do, but she's leaning on the law. They are trying to ignore her, and she is not going to be ignored.
This is Judge Karen Emmergut, mm-hmm. who is U.S. District Court judge in Oregon, a Trump appointee, mm-hmm. Initially blocked the use of the Oregon Guard mm-hmm. in Portland, and then again blocked the use of the California National Guard being brought into Portland.
That was the workaround, yeah.
And now there's thought that the Texas National Guard could be deployed to Oregon, to Portland specifically. Terry, what do you see unfolding here? What do you see as the significance of what's happening in Portland?
I think it comes down to scope, and I think that's generally where the courts have tried to rein the administration in. Mm-hmm. If the administration is sending federal assets in to protect federal interests or to advance the cause of federal agents implementing federal law, they're well within their rights. If they step out of bounds, that's where they're going to get themselves in trouble. And I think what you're seeing in places like Portland in particular, Solomon mentioned, very progressive city, obviously vehemently opposed to the administration's immigration policies. There are numerous instances where Antifa or affiliated groups are disrupting, particularly overnight, federal assets, ICE folks coming in and out of and what have you. And the mayor there is not particularly interested in having local police step up and protect those facilities. So to the extent the administration is going to send National Guard in to protect those assets, I think they're within their rights.
Yeah. Do you see this sort of, though, Terry, as a quick follow-up, this sort of push, do you see it teeing up as this fight between the judges, the judicial branch, and the executive here? Because you have judges repeatedly trying to put parameters around this and the Trump administration trying to wiggle out of it and do workarounds.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this could come down, given what's at stake here, both from a policy perspective and how this is playing out, this could go down as one of those major historical fights over federalism. We're talking like 1832, Andrew Jackson sending troops into South Carolina over tariffs, or things around the early days of the Civil War, 1963.
The stakes are that high, potentially.
They really are that high. And so we'll see how it plays out.
Do you see a potentially historic showdown here, Solomon Jones, as well? And I will point out that this all comes in the aftermath of a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court about the power of what a U.S. District Court judge says, the applicability of that ruling. I don't know how much that is factoring into what the Trump administration is doing right now in their internal thinking, but this does feel like the continuum of something pretty major playing out here, Solomon. I'm curious if you agree.
I think that the Supreme Court is going to play a major role in all of this. The Supreme Court has served almost as a rubber stamp to much of what the Trump administration has wanted to do. They have reversed federal court judges, reversed appeals courts numerous times with some of these policies. But I agree with you in terms of looking at the scope of what a federal judge can do. They can make a ruling that applies locally. They can no longer have these national injunctions. But this judge is again, not going to be ignored, not going to be worked around by the Trump administration. Now, what this means for other cities, including Philadelphia, in terms of the placement of National Guard in cities, is going to have huge implications nationally.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about some of the remarks that the president made about, you know, the military using these cities as training grounds.
Yes.
And I just, you know, I'm wondering about that. We heard about what happened in Chicago with people sort of scaling walls, doing ICE, arrests and all sorts of things. Just your thoughts about that statement, what it says, and the fire that it sort of adds to this battle between the judiciary and the Trump administration over, you know, federal troops being in cities.
I think that, and I just wrote a column about this for the Inquirer. I think that you have to take the whole meeting between those 800 some military commanders and Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump. Pete Hegseth said that, there is this enemy and that the enemy needs to be chased, hunted, killed. Trump then gets up and says, we have an enemy within and our military needs to use these dangerous cities as a training ground. I think those two things taken together should be of great concern to anyone living in an American city. I think that when you look at what the Trump administration is doing and using these National Guard troops to quell protests, peaceful protests, the people in Portland, I kind of chuckled when my colleague here talked about Antifa, you know, doing all this stuff overnight. The people in Portland are doing a cha-cha slide. They are not, doing these violent protests there, at least not in the moment. And so I think that it's an excuse. And I wonder what happens when the elections come around and we've normalized the presence of troops in cities. I think that it is a preparation for something bigger when the elections come around.
Terry, I take it you disagree on that characterization of what's going on in Portland. Now, I should note that the federal judge did say that these protests were, quote, not significantly violent or disruptive. That was her characterization of what's going on there. Do you see something different on the ground? Because the one of the big questions here, of course, is this just a pretense to send in National Guard because that's something that Trump wants to do? Or are they responding to a legitimate issue with the enactment of federal authority, legitimate federal authority?
I don't think it's either or. I think that there are plenty of people out in the streets of Portland who are protesting peacefully and well within their rights. And, we should support their ability to do so. But I do think there are dangerous elements operating in some of these cities as well. And, you know, I think 80 or 90% of the deportations or deportation efforts that have occurred so far have been with people who are either criminal or illegal aliens or folks who already have deportation process underway. And so to the extent that, listen, in my perspective, there's two major issues or a much more sort of constructive way, I think, for Democrats to achieve their aim here. One is for Congress to reassert its authority. I'm sure we're going to get there with the shutdown stuff.
Yeah, and we're about to go there.
The more they're shut down, the more power you give this guy. The other thing I would say is allowing local police who know the difference between a bad actor on the ground and someone who's exercising their First Amendment rights or is a longtime resident who support, that would go a long way, having local officials cooperate with federal forces to sort this out.
And by the way, we're gonna have to move on. By the way, John on YouTube says the National Guard visiting cities is not an effort to deter crime, but to quell dissent and practice fascism. Sid says, Edward from Warminster says, people need to protest smart, dress up as clowns, not get in the way of the National Guard. And by the way, Melinda on Facebook says, our politicians are not doing their jobs.
Before we move on real quick, though, Tara, I just want to ask you about the efficacy of the federal courts right now and whether or not they're just able to respond quickly to some of these challenges. I mentioned earlier this Supreme Court decision about national injunctions. I'm not sure it's directly applicable here, but it's this idea that the judicial system is always playing whack-a-mole with executive authority. Do you worry about that? Do you see that, or do you see it differently?
Yeah, it's a big issue, but I think that the larger issue is Congress. Congress in the Constitution is the primary branch of government. Congress is putting the judiciary in this position because it can't function. So the judiciary, by and large, is operating the way it ought to operate. The problem is Congress. Congress needs to get its act together, and we're in this position because of Congress.
Speaking of Congress, you forced me into a good transition.
We're talking about the shutdown.
So the federal government shutdown is entering now its second week, work week at least. There's no sign of a deal between Republicans and Democrats. Solomon Jones.
Yes.
When we think about the government shutdown, what do you see as sort of your biggest concern right now with the ongoing shutdown? And where is your focus when you think about this issue?
Well, it's interesting because I worked for Congress for a number of years. And what I know is that you do nothing if you're not in the majority. If you're not in the majority, you can make a lot of noise. But you can't call a hearing. You can't bring up legislation. You can't do anything in Congress unless you're in the majority except protest. And so when you talk about Congress not using its authority, it's because the Republicans who are in charge are not using their authority. They are standing back and allowing Donald Trump to run over them and to take away basically their constitutional authority to decide where we spend money, to decide what legislation we bring up, to decide what hearings we have. All of those things are functions of Congress. I agree. But where I disagree is that Republicans are in charge and they are not using their power in Congress. And so this shutdown really is about forcing, I think, the American public to see what's happening with Congress, whether or not we are going to have health care for regular Americans, not illegal aliens, but as we're going to have health care or not for regular American people who deserve to have that health care. I think it's a way to try to shut down the Affordable Care Act for Republicans and a way to try to bring it back for Democrats.
And Terry, I'd love to give your thoughts on what Solomon had to say. And also, I mean, the Democrats have said this is about health care, but it's also about the impoundment of funds, the rescission of funds, the clawback of funds, and the lack of trust between the parties, because they're like, if we cave this time, there's nothing to say that the executive will not hold back or change or use all these powers that they say don't really exist to mess up whatever deal is made. Your thoughts?
I hate shutdown politics because everybody's a hypocrite.
Okay.
So everybody's a hypocrite. We could talk, going back to the last one, this is the sixth shutdown in 30 years. Mm-hmm. Sixth, both parties, administration both ways, majorities both ways. This is the sixth time we've gone through this circus. It's ridiculous. So that's number one. You know, the idea that you would hold this up over shut down the entire government over a policy disagreement is ridiculous. And I have to say, as a constitutional conservative, the one thing I do find encouraging is I love watching Democrats fall in love with the filibuster all over again. Right?
We had a whole show about the filibuster.
We had this conversation, right? And it's very encouraging to see the Democrats use their constitutional leverage to in the Senate to, I mean, I think it's a bad use of it, obviously, but obviously I think protecting the filibuster is a good thing. But I will say, look, Chuck Schumer has voted for one of these continuing resolutions 13 times. Mm-hmm. We just did it a couple of months ago to keep the government open. This is not a good use of that leverage.
Democrats have a point in the sense that the president refused to meet with them for 9 months, and they had been asking for a meeting. Do you think that they have a point that, you know what? I mean, before there wasn't all these rescissions and impoundments and all these things where the Congress had allocated funds and the executive refused to release those funds. I mean, do you think that there are some points in that the president is overstepping?
Why is that not the point that they're arguing to the public then? If they're making a constitutional argument, then why are they all over the Sunday shows
talking about the healthcare thing is more politically popular, but the healthcare
thing is actually preposterous, because I saw Senator Welch from Vermont on I forget which show yesterday morning, and he makes this argument that people making $100,000 a year cannot afford their healthcare premiums. Doesn't that tell you all you need to know about what the Affordable Care Act has done to the cost of healthcare in this country, along with other factors as well? But if you're making $100,000 a year and the existing subsidies and the existing exchange are not affordable to purchase a plan, and you need additional taxpayer relief, which was contemplated because of COVID, let's be honest.
Yeah.
But you need additional taxpayer this is government spending driving inflation, driving costs out of control. You need government spending to bring the cost down, and the cost goes back up. It's cyclical. It's not going to solve the problem. I think it's a losing argument.
And let me ask you, Solomon Jones, mm-hmm. because one thing that Terry brought up there is Chuck Schumer's position in all this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's plenty of speculation that this is not about health care. This is not about pocket rescissions. This is ultimately about Chuck Schumer keeping his job because he's feeling the heat from the left wing of his party. Do you believe that's a big factor here?
Well, you know how you keep your job? You do your job. That's how you keep your job. And so mm-hmm. he's doing his job. I don't see anything wrong with someone trying to keep their job by doing it. Now, if you're trying to keep your job by manipulation, or you're trying to keep your job by knocking somebody else out of their position, that's one thing. But to keep your job by doing your job, yeah, I'm in favor of that. I think the other thing is that the Affordable Care Act actually made healthcare affordable for Americans. Now, we can spin it however we want to, but there are 20-some million people who are going to lose their healthcare if these subsidies don't remain in place. Why are prices going up? Well, we could probably look at tariffs. Why are prices going up? Well, we could probably look at bad economic policy. But in terms of prices overall, in terms of healthcare, I don't think there's any argument that the Affordable Care Act made healthcare affordable for Americans, and we need to keep it that way.
How are Democrats doing on messaging for this? Because, I mean, it's a two-part. I mentioned healthcare, but they're also talking about these rescissions and impoundments.
Yeah.
It's not clear. Yeah. Do you feel like it's clear? Do you feel like it's sort of breaking through and resonating with majority of Americans?
Well, here's the other thing. I think that you can never argue the Constitution with the American people, because most of us don't know what the Constitution says. That's number one.
That part. Yeah.
You can't argue rescissions and other procedural things in Congress with the American people, because we don't know how Congress works and really don't care. All we care about is that our taxes remain low, that prices remain low, that things remain affordable for us. We don't want to know the details. And I think that's where Democrats make the mistake over and over and over again. Their messaging is far too complicated. Keep it simple.
Penny on YouTube says, as someone who's part of a government family, I'm interested in hearing all things related to when this shutdown will be over. I mean, look, we're just sitting here in Philadelphia trying to read the tea leaves, Terry Tracy, but do you have a sense that this is at all close to resolution?
No. No, it's not close.
Straight up, no.
And because the White House loves everything about this. I mean, Chuck Schumer just made Russ Vought the most powerful man in America.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that, by the way, this is director of OMB, who has been instrumental in part of this broader effort to reduce the federal workforce, and now potentially has an opening.
This is why I think this is a very peculiar hill to die on. You want to have a debate about health care and affordability of health care? The midterms are coming up. It has played very well for Democrats in past elections. So let's have that debate. But, you know, I saw Angus King on, again, I don't know what show yesterday, but he's like, I'm terrified of giving this administration this kind of power by shutting the government down.
And there's been threats of layoffs and all sorts of things.
And they have just been waiting for this, because they're not just looking at going after the political appointees. They're looking at totally restructuring how personnel is managed in the federal government. And, you know, under normal circumstances, they just wouldn't have this much leverage. And that's exactly what Chuck Schumer just gave them.
I guess we should transition out to our next topic.
Yeah, next to international news, there's renewed hope of a ceasefire agreement in Gaza as we approach the 2-year anniversary of the October 7th attacks. Negotiators from Israel and Hamas, they are meeting with mediators today in Egypt. On Friday, Hamas expressed willingness to release the remaining Israeli hostages, although much remains unresolved. you know, Trace, you know, Terry Solomon, you know, will this actually mean peace in Gaza? Your thoughts at this point?
I don't know that anything will ever mean peace in Gaza unless the Palestinians get a piece of land. Unless they get someplace to call home. That was the original intent when the United Nations created Israel in 1948. There was supposed to be a two-state solution. There has never been a two-state solution. And so I think that remains a problem. I think peace at the point of a gun is an interesting way to go about this. I think that's what Donald Trump is doing on behalf of, you know, our allies in Israel. And I just don't know that that is something that's going to be effective long term. I think people will continue to fight. They'll do what they have to do in order to try to fight, even if it's just throw rocks. It reminds me of what's happening with the government shutdown. Democrats have shut down, have agreed to a government shutdown because that's all they had.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that when you look at what's happening in Gaza, that's all they have. Yeah.
There is some evidence, however, that President Trump and his emissary there have actually gotten through to Bibi Netanyahu on some level, Terry Tracy, and forced him to seriously think about peace for the first time, despite the fact that the right-wing coalition in Israel seems none interested in that. Do you think the president is actually making some inroads here that could lead, if not to a lasting peace, at least a temporary peace? Your thoughts?
We should all be very skeptical about any kind of lasting peace, but I do think the president deserves a lot of credit here. I mean, he's brought a very disparate group of Gulf and even some Southeast Asian Muslim nations together to be able to say, like, enough is enough, and let's try to get these hostages out of here and see if there's some kind of framework for going forward. Everyone from Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Turkey and Indonesia. So it's an impressive collection of some allies and some not allies who are coming together to try to broker some kind of peace here. I was touched by a lot of the comments I saw from Israeli Jews over the weekend, hopeful that some of these hostages are going to be released. I didn't realize of the 48 still outstanding, 25 of them or so are presumed dead. That's horrible. But look, I think we have to break this down into its component parts, which is one, get the hostages out. Mm-hmm. Two, get some kind of ceasefire, ending the war, get the Israelis back to, I think they're calling it the yellow line or what have you. Three is some kind of governing construct. How can the Palestinians govern themselves without Hamas being the ones that are calling the shots? And then four, which will be, you know, arguably the hardest part, is rebuilding Gaza.
And it sounds like that is not going to be something that happens overnight. We have some time for that. We're going to try to squeeze one more story in.
Yeah. So before we get to local news, the other side of this break, last week, we did learn that Bad Bunny will headline the Super Bowl halftime show in February. That triggered backlash from some conservatives, including threats from, among others, Kristi Noem, that ICE would be in the crowd of the Super Bowl because Bad Bunny is the act. I mean, look, I feel like we're playing like culture war Mad Libs here, Solomon Jones. It makes my head spin. What was your reaction to the Bad Bunny announcement and the Bad Bunny blowback?
Yeah, I thought that it was a great choice to choose Bad Bunny. He's one of the top streaming artists in the world. He's an international sensation. And he's somebody who could speak to some of what's happening in terms of the culture wars. Of course, you have folks on the other side who are willing to fight over everything, including somebody singing some songs, doing a dance, you know, appearing at an event. It's crazy at this point. It becomes very petty and small. I think that Bad Bunny, by its very presence, helps to alleviate some of the tensions that we have, or at least he should, if other people are willing to grow up.
Yeah, and your thoughts on this, Terry, and especially, you know, the Republicans have had big inroads in the Latino community, mm-hmm. and Bad Bunny, Puerto Rican, huge Latino following. How do you think it'll impact when you have threats like this at the Super Bowl, a very American thing?
Can I be honest?
Yeah.
My gut reaction was, who cares? I mean,
that's
honestly.
That's a big question here. Yeah. No, the big question here is, how much of this is real? How much do real people care about this stuff, or is it a fabrication of internet
trolling
culture?
This is social media trolling at its finest, of which, you know, I think it's legitimate to criticize senior members of the administration who participate
right,
in this.
Right, because that's when it gets
real. And I think it's almost audition.
They're making it real.
Look, I think it's a bad choice. But I think it's a bad choice for the NFL, not because of any political reason. I just think they could have found somebody better. I don't think
like
this
who?
Is a real issue.
Like
huh?
who?
He had, he's
like who? He's one of the top streaming in the, artists yeah. in the world.
Well, Solomon,
he's an international
to be honest with you,
superstar.
This is just my opinion. Yeah. I don't really care.
No, I mean,
you know what I mean?
Like who? Like, who would have been better?
I don't. I mean, who did it last year?
Kendrick Lamar,
yeah, I'm bring them back. I don't know. I was like completely underwhelmed by the choice, and I don't think this is a real issue, particularly crazy. Relative to everything else we have going on.
Well, look, we touch on everything here.
We do.
And we appreciate your flexibility. We're going to get into the local stuff, which we're going to nerd out on the other side of this break. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. Much more to come on Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Before we get back to our political roundtable, I want to shout out an event that we are hosting on Sunday. I will be in Princeton, New Jersey at the Yankee Doodle Tap Room, humming my heart out, doing a live interview.
Hum away, Avi.
Doing a live interview with a local historian to discuss Princeton's significance in the American Revolution. There will also be a walking tour after the interview. It's part of a series of events WHYY is hosting ahead of the nation's upcoming 250th anniversary. There's limited availability for this event, so if you want to join me Sunday at 1 p.m. in Princeton, email tavern250, that's the number 250, at WHYY.org.
All right, so now let's get back to our news roundtable. And for this part of the discussion, we're going to talk about the big stories closer to home, from the budget impasse in Harrisburg to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court race, as well as a few other stories. So let me reintroduce our guests. We have Terry Tracy, founder of Broad and Liberty and CEO of Federi News Network. We also have Solomon Jones, Philadelphia Inquirer columnist and host on WURD Radio.
And our question for you, our listeners, is what news story is top of mind? 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on Facebook or YouTube, put your comments in the chat. Brian says, too hot for Studio 2 is the genocide in Palestine because you fear for your job. Well, I just said it, Brian. We'll see if I get fired.
All right.
Matt says the short-term continuing resolution would have been for what, 17 days? So even without the continuing resolution, can we expect the appropriations bill is being negotiated so it will be ready for passage after 17 days? Just a few of your thoughts out there. Let's talk about some local stuff now. Mm-hmm. No news is bad news when it comes to Pennsylvania's budget negotiations. We haven't heard really any substantial updates recently. The state budget is now 3+ months late. What's going on here, Terry Tracy? Dysfunction in Washington seems like dysfunction in Harrisburg as well. I know you're watching this closely. What are your big takeaways?
Yeah, compounding dysfunction, plus when you look at what's going on in a lot of the counties in our area from a tax and spending standpoint, it's just a ticking time bomb for the taxpayer and many, many vulnerable residents. So it's unfortunate. This is the third year Governor Shapiro has not been able to pass a budget on time. You know, he came into office with a $43 billion budget and an $8 billion surplus. He's proposing a $52 billion budget. The $8 billion surplus is gone. And there's a $1.6 billion structural deficit in what he's proposing. It's a bad deal for Pennsylvanians, and it's the opposite of getting you know what done.
Yeah.
Solomon, I take it you disagree, but
I do.
But look, I mean, Shapiro, that is his political mantra. Get sugar, honey, iced tea, done.
Yeah.
And look, here we are, months later.
Yep.
This is supposed to be one of his calling cards, getting people with disparate political opinions to cooperate and get things done. I mean, is this an issue for him?
Who votes on the budget?
Who votes on the budget?
So again, you know, having worked in a couple of legislative bodies, because I worked in city council too, had a lot of jobs, Avi. So the legislature votes on the budget. And you've got the Pennsylvania Senate, elements in the Pennsylvania Senate, holding up the budget because they don't agree with the governor. They don't want to agree with Democrats. And parenthetically, they don't want Philadelphia to get more than they think Philadelphia should, which is ironic, given that most of the money in the state comes from Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And so when you're talking about what happens with the budget, I think you have to look at the legislature first. It's sexy to say it's one person. It's the governor. It's Governor Shapiro. It's him. You know, well, it's a little more complicated than that. He puts out his ideas. They vote on it. They come to some agreement, and then he signs it. but they have to vote on the budget. That's what's happening, and that's why it's being held up.
By the way, the latest Quinnipiac poll gave Josh Shapiro a 60% approval rating, which is a bump up from his 59% approval rating. So it seems like people are not influenced by this budget impasse. Yeah. But I want to talk about the politics of this as we go into a gubernatorial race here in Pennsylvania for next year. I mean, Stacey Garrity, state treasurer, has rolled out this loan program, right, to help counties and different agencies that are sort of, you know, broke because they haven't gotten their state funding. Is there a political moment for her here, for Republicans, because of this impasse?
I think it depends on how people see it. At this point, the Pennsylvania not having a budget is not something that people feel yet.
Yeah, especially now that SEPTA.
But they might,
now
that SEPTA, they might start yeah, to right? feel it, though. We're hearing from some counties, mostly yeah. in the western part of the yeah. state, about furloughing people, about borrowing large chunks of money. It's often said, Terry Tracy, that you need some pain before these negotiations really get going. Are we close to the pain day that could speed up some actual substantive talks here?
Yeah, there was a well-done report by your colleagues out in the Pittsburgh market that reported the pain that was starting to be felt by the counties, a lot of nonprofit organizations, particularly in the southwestern part of the state. This is a much more affluent, to Solomon's point. We send a lot of money out to Harrisburg, and that's because there is a lot of money here. So it's a more affluent area. So it's harder for the pain to reach critical mass. You're already feeling in some subsets of the region, but it's harder for it to reach critical mass such that it has political implications. But purely on the politics of it, it is giving Stacey Garrity a really unique opportunity. She came out with this loan program, and then the Kim Ward, the Senate Majority Leader, came out shortly thereafter and said, well, the treasurer by law is not permitted to make these interest-free loans, but the Senate can pass, the legislator can pass something that makes these loans interest-free so that there's no cost to the folks that need the money. And I think that will be interesting to see how it plays out. I got to be honest with you. I purely from a process standpoint, you can tell, like, process to me matters. So I agree with you. It is about the legislator getting it done. And it's the same issue in Harrisburg that is in Washington in many ways. However, there is also a Democratic House. And so 50% of the legislator are Democrats. And as far as Governor Shapiro goes, when he interviewed for this job, he knew this. He knew there was a Republican Senate, right? He knew the House was going to be closely divided. Quite frankly, because of the gerrymandered districts, he's lucky to have a Democratic House. Republican candidates got 350,000 more votes statewide for state House candidates than Democrats did, and yet the Democrats have a one-seat majority. So he's lucky to actually have some leverage in the legislature. But he has not been, he himself, the governor, has not been at the negotiating table. Yeah. And it makes me wonder if it's too messy and his eyes are set on something else.
You come into negotiations at the end if you're the person in charge. Bob Brady used to do this on a regular basis. He'd come in when a deal was almost done, and he would take credit for making that deal. And so Governor Shapiro at this point knows that no deal is imminent. Why would he come in and make himself look bad? That would be silly for him. The end's
94 days now.
Yeah.
Well,
and what do you think Solomon is going to turn up the heat to make the legislators get together and make a deal?
I think the people have to get out in the street. I think people have to be affected. I think people have to be hurt, and they have to make it known that they're being hurt. That's not going to happen in Philly for a while, but it might happen in some of these other parts of the state that these Republicans who are not passing the budget represent. The House, that Democratic House that Terry spoke about, passed a version of the budget. The Senate has not.
And by the way, we're going to move on now and talk about the Pennsylvania Supreme Court race. We're now less than a month away from Election Day 2025. November 4th is looming. The biggest race, as I mentioned, here in Pennsylvania is a judicial retention contest. Voters can give a thumbs up or a thumbs down to three Democratic judges on the state's high court. A lot of attention, Terry, has been paid to this race. We've seen ads, some of them a little unscrupulous, or should I say a lot unscrupulous. You know, what's at stake here when you talk about the high court and specifically for Democrats?
Well, I think this is another example of a breaking of norms that we're probably going to look back at some point in the near future and regret. You know, historically, both parties have supported retention unless there was some sort of egregious issue with a particular judge. both parties have started to break those norms over recent years, and sort of at the county and regional. Now this is reaching the top levels of the court system in the state. You know, I would say the best argument for me, Republicans are pointing to a number of things. They're pointing to how the court handled the lockdowns during COVID. They're pointing to Wolf's emergency powers. They're pointing to Act 77 being deemed unconstitutional by the Commonwealth Court and then overturned by the Supreme Court. This is not a political point, but more of a, I think, more of a substantive point. The biggest argument against the Supreme Court judges, in my mind, is what they did with redistricting. They were well within their rights, I think, to say the maps were unconstitutional. But when they took the step, particularly in the run-up to the midterm elections during the first Trump term, of basically drawing their own maps and not kicking it back to the legislator, that's where they really crossed the line. And I think, to me, if the Republicans had a truly substantial argument to make against these guys, it's that one.
But even then, you still see this as a slippery slope type of situation.
It's totally a slippery slope, but I just don't. We're not going back. I mean, you know, look how the conversation goes today. We're not going back.
And for you, Solomon, what's at stake for Democrats? I mean, three judges, they have a majority here right now.
Voting rights.
Yeah.
So mail-in ballots are still a thing because we have a Democratic Supreme Court here in the state of Pennsylvania. I think that our voting rights are at stake. I think that it's clear that you have folks who don't want everyone to be able to vote. And I think that their stance on that alone, for me, is enough for them to be retained.
Solomon, specifically, I have to get your thoughts on the third congressional race in Pennsylvania. Yeah. This is going to be a midterm in 2026 to replace Dwight Evans, who's retiring. Now, all apologies, Terry. This is mostly a Democratic infight here, but some big names have already come up in this race. Dr. Ayla Stanford, Sharif Street, Morgan Cephas, Chris Rabb, Dr. David Oxman. Just your quick take on that race, which is a rare chance for Philadelphia to get a new representative in Congress.
I've interviewed all of them. And I've known all of them except for Dr. Oxman, I believe, at Temple for a number of years. I think all of them are smart. I think all of them are capable. I think Sharif Street has the most political experience. Mm-hmm. But I think that Dr. Ayla Stanford, who is a surgeon, is brilliant. And I think at this point, she's the biggest name in the race. Now, Dwight Evans has endorsed her in this race. But I do think that we'll see if Sharif Street in particular has the political savvy to overcome that big name.
Quish, do you think that, you know, Dwight Evans putting his thumb on the scale, what does that do for Dr. Stanford?
I think that it does help her because, remember, Dwight Evans is somebody who's been in politics for a long time. We know him from his days in the state house, his days kind of controlling that budget, controlling that neighborhood up in the Northwest. And I think that what he says matters. And I think it's going to matter to folks going into the voting booth who don't know these other candidates, don't know Chris Rabb, don't know Dr. Oxman, don't know Sharif Street, but they know what Dwight Evans has done, and they'll respect what he says.
I saw her speak at the Pennsylvania Society 2 years ago when she was given the award, and she was very, very impressive. Yeah. And she was an absolute standout. I obviously, at least from what she said so far, I disagree with a lot of her own policy issues. I think a lot of the policy she's supporting would exacerbate the problems in the district she represents. But she is a brilliant woman. She is an impressive woman. And, you know, the residents of the 3rd District could do far worse, that's for sure.
Real quick, can we get New Jersey in real quick? Home stretch time for Democrat Mikey Sherrill and Republican Jack Cittarelli in the governor's race in New Jersey. I'll give this one to you, Terry Tracy. The polls show things tightening a bit. Republicans clearly see opportunity here in the Garden State. Are they being realistic?
This is Eagles Broncos all over again. This is the fourth quarter.
Who's
you
the
feel,
rep?
You feel the momentum. Well,
you're saying the Eagles are Mikey Sherrill, the Democrat, and that the comeback here by Cittarelli and the Broncos is very real.
It's as they say in politics, it's not how you start, it's how you finish. I think Cittarelli is. Has really spent the last several years building his name ID. I think he's a fit for the moment in New Jersey. New Jersey has a history of electing Republican governors, or at least recent history. Yep. Phil Murphy has been an unmitigated disaster. Lots of unforced errors by the Sherrill campaign. Early returns show in mail-in voting show Republicans, not in terms of absolute value, but in terms of return rate, higher than usual and ahead of Democrats. So I think it's moving in Cittarelli's direction.
Yeah. All right. We're going to wrap up.
Okay. So I want it from both of you. I want you to tell me the story that you think is not getting the airtime it deserves and we should be paying attention to. So the story that is not getting the airtime it deserves, Solomon.
Broad Street. 25-mile-an-hour speed limit on Broad Street.
Okay.
I think it speaks to what's been happening since the pandemic with crazy driving and people losing their lives in hit and runs and in car accidents. That 25-mile-per-hour speed limit on Broad Street, I've already gotten a warning for going 38 on Broad Street.
These new cameras, these automatic cameras.
Will it end up saving lives?
Yeah. That's good.
Terry Tracy, your thoughts on something under the radar here.
Montgomery County, Chester County, and Delaware County all spontaneously and concurrently passed ordinances, or in one case a resolution, creating these human relations commissions, alleging that there are marginalized communities under attack in the most affluent counties in the state. The thing that is, it's a little Orwellian, if you ask me, if you look at the way they presented, but I think the biggest issue that I have is that these county commissioners are giving volunteer commissioners subpoena power to adjudicate complaints over various discriminatory remarks or practices in businesses or other civic institutions. It requires much more scrutiny than it's received so far, constitutional and otherwise.
All right.
Interesting.
Well,
I had not heard of that story. I'm going to have to look that up.
This has been a fascinating conversation. I have to say, if you think it's easy to get up here and talk about like 17 different issues in an hour, it's not. Thanks
they
to
had
you
homework.
Both.
So thank you both. for being prepared today. We appreciate that.
Terry Tracy, founder of Broad and Liberty, CEO of Fideri News Network. Thank you so much for your time today.
Of course.
Solomon Jones, Philadelphia Inquirer columnist and WURD radio host, who actually does talk about 3,000 issues under the sun every day. So is an old pro at this. Thanks, Solomon.
Thank you.
Yes, and thank you to everybody who emailed in. Sid says, still sucky schools, persistent poverty, and guns galore in Philly. So Sid has a lot of stories he'd like us to cover. By the way, thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calliquet engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk with you tomorrow.